Hey, Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure and honor.
I have a few set of questions which are of rapid fire. The first question I had is, what is the best advice you've ever received?
The best advice that I've ever received was from my basketball coach in high school. So basketball was always my favorite sport, and I didn't start playing it competitively until high school. So when I was in ninth grade, I tried out for the team. And I remember, distinctly remember, my basketball coach. He had a military background. And this is some advice he shared with me. He said, you know what, Rachel, you know, this is, you know, your first time playing competitive. And he said, you know, if you work hard now, he said, you can apply this to, you know, your career, your future career. He said, if you work hard now, you can play later, or your life will be easy later. And, you know, I've just kind of taken that to heart. And even in my career and my aspirations throughout high school and college, and that's just something that stuck with me, you know, work hard now so that I can live a little bit easier later.
Nice. How would you define the role of a lobbyist in one sentence?
One sentence. I would say collaborating with a lobbyist collaborates with elected officials to influence legislation on behalf of a larger group of people.
Nice. Do you get energized by policy or by politics?
I like policy better. Sometimes politics can make the work that I do a little bit challenging and sometimes frustrating. There's so many stories I can tell. So I like the policy aspect of it. I like helping to develop policies and, you know, doing the research. So one of the things that I do in my role is I'm not just meeting with elected officials, collaborating with elected officials, but I'm also making sure that the research that I'm presenting to them is good and reliable. So I'm conducting the 50 state surveys, looking at what social scientists are saying, looking at what the media is saying. So I take all of this data, and it's very tedious. And then I present it in a succinct one page fact sheets or one pagers, and then send it to the lobbyist so that I know that the work that I'm doing to try and create a policy or influence a policy is based on reliable information.
And what is the challenging part of your job?
Yeah, so sometimes, you know, politics can play a role. For example, I am right now tracking a piece of legislation in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles City Council is proposing to raise the minimum wage for hotel workers and airport workers at LAX airport from $18 to $25 an hour. And this piece of legislation was driven by a workers' union, and the union is using its political influence to push this legislation. And while, you know, I am all for, you know, workers, or the organization I work for, we're all for workers earning a livable wage. However, the way in which this union is driving this legislation, you know, they, you know, I've donated a lot of money to the elected officials. So, you know, they have, you know, a sense of power. And then there's even been instances where members of the city council have not even, you know, read, or maybe not for this, in this instance, but I've seen instances where members of city council have not read the ordinance or a bill. And so they just rely on what a union or another lobbyist has said is in the bill. And sometimes these bills are 200 pages. And so if you're a lawmaker, you really rely on, you know, these lobbyists on all sides to come in and inform you, okay, what does this bill actually do? This bill might on its face seem like a positive thing for the citizens or your constituents, but hey, whoa, you know, I can think of a bill in California right now where, you know, the language seems, you know, on its face a positive thing, but it can actually backfire and have negative ramifications. So I think it's super important for lobbyists to inform lawmakers, you know, the ins and outs of bills, especially when, you know, lawmakers, they have a very heavy load. I remember meeting with a person in Texas, and the Texas legislature meets every other year, and they go through 10,000 bills in the span of just a few months. So I think it's, and some of these bills, some bills are one page long, and then some are over 200 pages long. And so sometimes, you know, there are some lobbyists out there or organizations that will use that to their advantage to try and, you know, say, oh, this bill is doesn't really have that much of an impact, when in actuality, like, yes, it does, you know. And so I think it's definitely important for, you know, lobbying and what it is that we do. And I guess that's the political side that's, you know, a little frustrating, especially for someone like myself, who's, I'm thankful that I work for an organization or an association that has a very, it's well known and it's developed this reputation. But, you know, if I were just on my own and, you know, trying to, I don't know, create a name for myself, I think it would be, you know, a challenge because you have, you know, people who are, who've been in the game a long time. So, and it is a game.
Mm-hmm. What three skills you think are essential for someone to be a good lobbyist?
Yeah, so I would say skill number one, this is a very great question. Skill number one would be the ability to build relationships and that assertiveness. So reaching out to, not being afraid to reach out to elected officials, stakeholders. I work for a trade association, so I meet with members of, on several occasions, regional directors and our board. So just kind of building these relationships and having sit downs and meetings, attending meetings where these lawmakers are present, attending events where these lawmakers are present. And then if, you know, if you work for an association and you, your association is planning events, inviting those elected officials to those events, building those relationships, speaking with them one-on-one. I've spoken with several lawmakers on the state, local, and federal level. And in my experience, they have been, you know, some of the most down-to-earth people that I've met. So skill number one, building relationships, learning how to build relationships, and not just with elected officials, but also potential coalitions. So other organizations who are thinking the same way that you are, or advocating in this for the same things that you are. So building those relationships with other organizations and associations. I would say number two, attention to detail. I have a legal background. I think that that's helped me. You know, I'm a law school graduate. I think that's definitely helped me with being able to read a bill. And, you know, because there are differences between and versus or, this idea of shall or must. So just this attention to detail that's super, super important. And then number three, I would say research. Having those research skills. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is conducting 50 state surveys and looking at how different states have approached a certain issue. And so if you have the research skills to do that, then that will definitely help you. Like for example, I remember when I was in law school, we were trying to raise the age of criminal responsibility in Georgia, because Georgia, after we conducted the 50 state survey, we realized at the time that 41 states had set the age to 18. And so what this bill was essentially, let's raise the age to when a child, so a person under the age of 18, can be tried as an adult. Georgia was one of seven states at the time that still had the age set below 18. And so we were able to present this data to lawmakers and say, hey, you know, 41 states have it set at 18. And then also looking at, you know, what social scientists are saying. And, you know, as an educator, you know, I was able to bring that in and say, okay, when a child is tried as a child, right, and through the juvenile court, that record is sealed upon their 18th birthday. If that 17-year-old is tried as an adult, that record is not sealed. And so that impacts them having to check the box on college applications, checking the box on career applications, job applications. So we're able to present that data to our lawmakers. So just having that research skill, I think is super important for being a lobbyist. So number one, relationship building. And then number two, this attention to detail. And then number three, the research skills.
Nice. Well done. Can you tell us, if you could have dinner with three people, dead or alive, who would they be?
Three people, dead or alive. This is a really great question. I don't want to sound cliche. Okay. So on a personal note, I would... I would love to have a conversation with my parents. So I lost my dad in 2015, and then I recently lost my mom. And so I would love to have a conversation with them and just kind of share with them, okay, all of the things that I'm doing, and you know, and just for them to be able to see or guess understand that, you know, all of my dreams have, because this is what I said I wanted to do. I remember when I was in high school, I took a civics class and it was in the middle of a presidential election, and everything that I was learning in class resonated with what was going on when I went home and watched the 6 o'clock news. So, you know, learning that, you know, 270 to win, you know, the Electoral College. And, you know, I remember going home and, you know, watching the news. Okay, what's the count? And I told my parents, you know, I want to go to law school and this is what I want to do. I want to work in the area of law. And so for them to just be able to see, you know, everything. So I would definitely say my parents, if I could have a conversation. I don't know if that counts as one or two people. Okay. And number two, I would like to speak with some historical figure. One doesn't really come to mind right now because I am a history buff. And I would just love to speak with one person in ancient history and just kind of see the day-to-day and living in the life. I like, and that's one reason why I like going to museums. And then the third person I would love to speak with, I'm gonna try to find someone who's alive. Think of someone who is alive. I would want to sit down with either a current or past governor and just interview them about how they got to be, or some type of some executive branch person, and just have a sit down and ask them, okay, how did you get into this? And preferably someone who may not have inherited that position, because one of the things I'm learning is that, you know, in politics, oh, their dad was so-and-so. So I would love to speak to someone who, you know, had maybe a different or non-traditional path and just how they got into politics and things like that.
Good choice. Thanks for sharing that. Let's go a little bit into your past. Can you tell us, like, you did mention that you were interested in politics right from high school. So was that how you started your journey into government relations? Like, you did law, but where, at what point did, you know, you jump into this government relations space?
Yeah, so absolutely. In ninth grade, I became a history buff, and then in 10th grade, I took a civics class, and I just loved civics. And I would say where I got my start, so I decided, okay, in high school, I was going to law school. I didn't know how. I didn't know how to get there. I didn't know anyone in law school. I didn't know a law school graduate, but I said, you know what? I'm going to go to law school when I, quote unquote, grow up. And so when I graduated, you know, I went to college and I researched, and I was told that history is, becoming a history major is one of the number one undergrad majors for law school because of the extensive amount of reading, or the volume of reading and analytical skills and critical skills that I would need for law school. So I was a history major, and then my sophomore year of going into my sophomore year of college, I went on this internship in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. I worked at Aliquippa Impact, and I have to credit them a lot for my journey because it was then that I kind of pivoted into my specialty. So growing up, both of my parents were teachers, and I convinced myself that teaching was not my calling. And it, primarily because of the administrative work, I saw my mom, she would come home grading papers. And I was like, this is not what I want to do when I grow up. And Aliquippa Impact happened. I worked with fifth and sixth grades, and it really changed my perspective on service to my communities and what that can look like. And I served children and families who were in marginalized neighborhoods. And I really developed this passion for serving communities who were underserved, underprivileged, so much so that when I returned back to college, I changed my major to history education. And I did teach for a year. And I realized, okay, I want to have a larger impact on children and families than, you know, the children who walk through my door. And so I decided to go to law school, and I interned when I was in law school. I interned at the Georgia State Capitol with the Emory Law School Barton Child Law and Policy Center. And I fell in love with lobbying, government affairs. It was so much fun. But I also knew that I was doing really, really important work. And one thing that stood out to me that kind of gave me this, okay, this is your calling, Rachel. This is what you should do with your life, is I remember, and this happened on several occasions, but one thing that sticks out to me is I remember tracking this bill. It was a very controversial bill that the Barton Center was not officially tracking it, because even though it impacted children and families, it was so controversial that, you know, we just decided not to track it officially. And so my classmates and I decided to take everything that we learned in this clinic from our professor on how to track legislation, how to pull lawmakers off the ropes, how to, you know, draft these one pagers. And we decided, okay, let's use this research. We conducted a 50-state survey. We did all the research and then did a one pager. And we somehow got it to, and it was the day that the I-85 collapsed and all of that was happening in Atlanta, Georgia. That same day, I remember going to the Capitol, and we drafted a one pager and got it to one of the sponsors of this bill. And it was about a 200 page bill, very big bill. And the sponsor of the bill gave our fact sheet, you know, presented it on the floor for debate. He literally quoted our research and some other research. And I'll never forget the Georgia Speaker of the House at the time was David Ralston, may he rest in peace. He quoted our research word for word and said, because of this data, let's pass this bill to improve outcomes for the 13,000 children across Georgia in foster care. And for me, it was this moment where, wow, you know, not only do I now know that I can do this, it's like, I want to do this. And I was just so happy. We all cheered. And it was just one of that defining moment that I'll never forget. And I'll always remember that. And I have another instance where I tracked a bill, it was a trafficking bill, a human trafficking bill. It would add the definition of sex trafficking to child abuse, which you think would be a no-brainer, but that wasn't in the Georgia statute, that sex trafficking was under the definition of child abuse. And I remember tracking that bill and being able to stand next to Governor Nathan Deal as he signed it into law. And so that was really, really cool. And that's how I knew, okay, this is what I want to do.
That's amazing. Thanks so much for sharing these stories. This is really cool. And I forgot to ask you, where did you grow up, and do you have any siblings, and, you know, how was your childhood like?
Yeah, so I grew up in North Carolina. I was born in Virginia, and then my parents moved to North Carolina. My dad was a pastor, so we kind of moved around sometimes. And I remember we moved to this really small town, really, really small town in North Carolina. It's called Como, North Carolina. We stayed there until I was about 11 years old. The town was so small. At the time, it had 99 people. And someone had a baby, and now we were in the triple digits, and it made the paper, and the mayor was so excited. You know, we now had 100 people. And yeah, so it was super small. And after my parents retired, when I was in middle school, we moved to a larger city, a larger town, Plymouth, North Carolina, which is not too far from the Outer Banks, where Nags Head. And that's where I ended up graduating from high school. That town has about 3,500 people. I still have, you know, my childhood, I consider that my childhood home. You know, I still have that back home and, you know, some of my friends from high school. So that was pretty much my childhood. Grew up in the country on a farm, and then we moved to the beach, and yeah.
Nice. That's cool. And your law degree was in from Emory University. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. So I have a law degree from Emory University. I'm an 18L, so I graduated in 2018. I have a Juris Master's in Child, Family, and Education Law. And yeah, so I completed the program May 2018.
Okay. And since you have been recently in the space and you just graduated, how would you tell, like, you know, the youth, like, you know, why do you think the youth need to be involved in government relations? Is it important for them to be a part of it? And if so, why?
It's so important. So after I graduated law school, I went back into the classroom because at the time I wanted to work in education policy and I wanted to gain more experience in education before I went back into government affairs. And, you know, more boots on the ground. And so I went back into the classroom for 5.5 years and I was an English teacher. I taught high school English. And then my last few years of teaching, I taught 12th graders and I piloted and built this multicultural literature course that taught students civic engagement and social awareness skills. And we, through literature, through composition, through essay writing. And I remember every spring, because it aligns with the legislative session, we would talk about different social issues, different things that they cared about, and then just trying to get them to understand the importance of their voice in not just education, but in things that they care about. Because at the end of the day, you know, these elected officials, they work for you, and trying to communicate to them, you know, they work for you. You know, you have the power to keep those elected officials, you know, in office. And so they will listen to you because they know they don't, they can be voted out. And so just kind of communicating to them the importance of voting, because a lot of my students, you know, they were 12th graders. They were either old enough to register to vote. So in Georgia, a person can register to vote if they're 17 and a half. And then they can actually vote at 18. So just getting them civically engaged. I had some students present a city revitalization project in Tequila, Georgia, how to revitalize the city to make it look like, you know, a downtown Duluth or downtown Lawrenceville. And they presented it to the mayor. And so just, I guess the importance of using their voice to influence change. So I think that's super important.
And so you've gone through a lot of hoops and now you're working for AAHOA, is that right? And yes. Can you tell us a little bit about what is that organization about and what is your role specifically here?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are AAHOA. I work for AAHOA, the Asian American Hotel Owners Association. It is the largest hotel owners association in the world. We have members throughout all 50 states, and we make up about, our members own about 60,000 hotels across the country. And And I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question?
What is your role specifically here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Western Division. So I have 29 states that I support on the local and state levels. So in the areas of, so I support hotel owners in the areas of combating human trafficking. So I mentioned earlier that I'm currently conducting 50 state surveys. So right now I am looking at, I'm conducting a deep dive into human trafficking lawsuits against hotel owners. Last year alone, 1,500 lawsuits were filed against hotels, and it varied by state to state. And one of the challenges with this is there are a lot of challenges because it varies from state to state, and we don't have strong legal precedents or Supreme Court case to kind of provide hotel owners with guidance. So a lot of times, you know, and that's why it's super important to conduct these 50 state surveys, because a hotel owner living in North Dakota might be sued for something different than a hotel owner in North Carolina. It just depends. So I conduct 50 state surveys. I'm also looking at ADA lawsuits against hotels, so the Americans with Disabilities Act. I support hotel owners in that area, so they're getting sued for an ADA violation. Just kind of giving them an educational resource. So that is what we are at AHOA. We are an educational resource for our hotel owners who are our members. So we do not give legal advice. We are a resource for them. So we combat human trafficking, ADA lawsuits, short-term rentals, so like Airbnbs, so we do a lot of work around that. Tort reform, so in the event a customer is injured on a hotel owner's property, right? So what happens there? We also look at tax reform. A lot of times hotel rates or the hotel tax, the hotels will be taxed because the city or the state is trying to fund, I don't know, a youth center. That just happened in Oklahoma. And so the hotel tax was raised, I think maybe 5 to 8% to fund this youth center. And it's always one of those questions, okay, where, well, you know, how do hotels get into this? You know, what did we do? How do we get thrown in the mix? But you know, it happens. And so that's one of the things that I work on. Recently, civil rights areas or things in civil rights, franchisee slash franchisor things. And I think that about covers it all. Oh, housing vouchers and things of that nature. So for example, there are states who provide homeless or unhoused individuals vouchers to stay at hotels. And we, as an association, are not opposed necessarily to these vouchers. It's just unhoused individuals are receiving these vouchers without any wraparound services. So there's no, okay, what if they need medical care, health care, a caregiver? So that's one of the issues that we are, I guess, combating and advocating for. Okay, local governments, if you're going to give these give unhoused individuals vouchers to stay at hotels, just to make sure that they have, you know, wraparound services as well.
That's really cool and inspiring. So, I mean, like with the experience you've had in managing, like, you know, 20 plus states, how easy or is it difficult for you to manage this many number of states? Usually I've heard only people handling just one state, right? You're doing so many multiple states. So what are the challenges of doing this?
Yes, great question. You know, some days I feel as though I am being pulled into 29 different directions. And honestly, organization is definitely the key to what I do. And, you know, I spoke with the president and CEO, Larley Blake. She's amazing, amazing, amazing person and advocate for hotel owners, has been for the past 20 years or so. And, you know, she said she was going to, you know, get me some help, which is nice. But, you know, there are some days where I feel that I am pulled into all these different directions. And so one way that I stay grounded, I guess, is I make a list every single day. You know, my colleagues would tell you that I am an avid note taker and I love my sticky notes. You know, they always come around and say, hey, Rachel, do you need anything? Yes, sticky notes. And I write down everything that is of priority for the day. And I cross those off. And whatever I can't finish today, you know, just understanding that there is a tomorrow, and then just maintain that communication piece, because I want to, you know, establish and maintain these relationships with these 29 individuals and just letting them know, hey, I understand that X, Y, and Z are a priority for you right now. And it's important to me also, but I, you know, I have 29 states and here are all the other things that I'm working on. I will prioritize this because it is important to me, you know, when I have a moment, I'll give them a set date. So just maintaining that communication and, you know, setting those boundaries, you know, what I can and cannot do, and understanding my limits, it has worked well for me.
That's great. With that, we come into the last segment where you have the opportunity to speak anything which I might have missed asking you about, any words of advice, do's, don'ts of lobbying, or your future. I mean, where do you see yourself in the next few years? So the platform is all yours.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I would just say, I really appreciate the time that, you know, I have to, you know, kind of share my story. And I would say the do's in lobbying, building relationships. And I hope this doesn't sound cliche, but that is literally the key to being successful. For example, I was in Phoenix, Arizona last week for our Southwest Regional Conference. So with the 29 states that I monitor, they are also split into regions. So my Southwest region is split. So there are four states represented in the Southwest. So those are Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. And so every year we have a regional conference and trade show in each one of those regions. And this past Thursday, I was at, you know, the regional and, you know, supporting our hoteliers, our members. And then we had a business meeting and we had elected officials come. And I was also, you know, inviting people to, or our members to donate to our PAC. So the association I work for has a political action committee. So this is where we donate money to, you know, elected officials and their campaigns. And so in order to do that, you know, we raise money. And I just remember communicating with a member, and he happens to be a president and CEO of another association. And he said, you know, he asked me about the PAC and how it was going. You know, in AHOA, we are, you know, developing our PAC and, you know, trying to build it. And he said, you know, when you get back, have your team meet with me. I'll show you how to, you know, raise money for your PAC. And he says, you know, in one night they raised over, you know, $300,000. And I said, okay, thank you. And so just building that relationship. And now I brought that information back to my team. And now we have a meeting set up with this individual next week to help grow our PAC. So I cannot stress enough the importance of building relationships. It's so important. And then don't take anything personally. This work is, sometimes it's very fast moving, and sometimes people will say things that are very direct. And so it's one of those instances where you can't take things personally. And even when you disagree with people, like for example, there's a, you know, a elected official who I, you know, we have a difference of opinion, but outside of, you know, the lobbying, we're outside of our work, we can, you know, collaborate and be civil and, you know, communicate, and maybe I wouldn't say friends, but we are cordial with one another. So I guess that those things. And then what was the last question? My future?
Yes.
Yeah. So currently I am a director of government affairs. In my future, as far as my 5-year plan, I would love to continue working in government affairs. This is what I want to do. You know, this is the end goal. And I would definitely love to at some point become a vice president of government affairs and just kind of mentor people and, you know, hold that leadership position. And then I would also love to, you know, go back into supporting youth in civic engagement, because I think it's so important, you know, with this generation and the trajectory of, you know, our country, our, and just kind of emphasizing, you know, it's, and I will say this piece, a lot of times, you know, people will show out to the polls for federal elections or the governor or gubernatorial elections or the governor elections. But it is so important to show out to the polls at our local elections, our state elections. Those are so, so important. So I guess that would be the piece of advice that I would leave, or my takeaway.
Rachel, I just want to conclude by saying that you are a rock star, and I'm pretty sure you will go places. You'll definitely reach the heights in government affairs. And you've not only done your team proud, but also your parents proud, I'm sure. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor.